from the nation's capital. This is DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Ladies and gentlemen, back at our microphones, Will Marling. He is the executive director of the National Organization for Victim Assistance, www.trinova.org, www.trinova.org. The show title today, ladies and gentlemen, What Do Victims of Crime Experience? You know, Will, we were talking before we hit the record button. One of the things that people do not understand, those of us in the criminal justice system, we don't have a clear understanding as to the victim experience. Unless we've been through it ourselves, we don't have that clear understanding as to what victims of crime, whether it be property crime or violent crime, what they experience. Correct or incorrect?
That is a common observation, Len, and thanks for having me.
Sure.
The realities that victims experience sometimes are fairly profound, but what many times people don't understand, they don't comprehend, is that they're fairly organic. And by that I mean when we are victimized, which is a word that can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people, when we're victimized or when we're harmed by another human being specifically, there are actually biological reactions that happen within our brains, in our bodies, that just happen. We are not even cognizant of those. It would be like I was sitting on the deck with my wife last summer. We were having coffee, and these two birds that were flying, chasing each other, flew within inches of my head mm-hmm. as they were flying. And I could not do anything but react very organically, very naturally. It was all instinctive. And so many times victims are responding, and what we try to quantify in that is the understanding of trauma and the loss that causes trauma. That's really where we try to look at this and say, okay, victimization is really about loss, and loss results in trauma.
Well, we, again, before hitting the record button, we were talking about change, fundamental change that is occurring within the criminal justice system throughout the country, the massive discussion that is now taking place on both sides of the political aisle, where we and they are discussing who should go to prison, whether or not that person should be in prison, whether or not that person should be on community supervision. Now the discussion through the MacArthur Foundation is switching over towards jails. Do we use jails to their best possible potential? Do we need to put as many people in jail as humanly possible? We have this discussion, and it's happening from a philosophical point of view, and it's happening from a limitation of government and best use of taxpayer dollars point of view, but mm-hmm. I'm not hearing the victim brought up in all of this. So it strikes me that if I've been burglarized or if I've been robbed or if I've gone through another sort of crime, that discussion becomes academic. I simply want to be safe. I simply
That's
want
right.
the criminal justice system to act responsibly. I understand that, but I simply want to be safe. So that draws out some interesting juxtapositions on the part of victims of crime, does it not?
It does, yeah. The struggle many times is that folks who experience something like the harm that somebody brings on them, whether that's the loss of a valuable piece of property or the loss of physical function because you're assaulted or, you know, the horrible things that occur like child abuse, sexual assault, homicide, those have naturally occurring responses. And our justice thinking as a human being is, wait a minute, this isn't right. This person should be held accountable. Many times there's just an instinctive restitution dimension that we bring into that. And I don't mean that in some kind of official formal sense. I just mean, you know, justice or a sense of rightness says, no, wait a minute, a person should be held accountable. And in many situations, we would want them to repay. And that's the difficulty, because the system itself is trying to address those, and yet many victims would say, if they're not part of this process, they would say, you know, the system really doesn't necessarily serve my interests, or it doesn't hear me. And that's why in the movement, you know, I've been in and honored to be part of, there's been attempts over the past 30 years specifically and intentionally to get victims more involved in the process, or to allow them, I should say, to have a stronger voice, like with victim impact statements and sentencing, or victim notification of processes and procedures. So when you're talking about some of these important discussions, and I want to affirm that, these important discussions about jail and incarceration and overcrowding, I've been fortunate to be asked to participate in some of those conversations. And in so doing, I would still affirm that many people aren't considering the victim's perspective necessarily. They're concerned about a lot of issues, but not necessarily how the victims might contribute to solutions that we're trying to address.
Well, any member of a General Assembly at the state level, any member of the United States Congress is going to sit there and say to themselves, okay, we're talking about individuals that we ordinarily would put in jail and ordinarily we would put in prison, and we're talking about not doing that any longer. And I think it's inevitable because of the victims' movement for the last 30, 40 years, it's inevitable for that member, that member of the legislature, whether it be state or federal, to sit there and go, well, how does that impact the individual who's been victimized? What does it do to them? Do they see this as justice? Do they see we within the criminal justice system taking their point of view into consideration? Or, quite frankly, are we making their circumstances as victims even more dangerous? All of that comes into it, does it not?
All of that comes into it. And that's a conversation that we really do need to have. Sometimes the struggles, of course, with these conversations is that folks are very aligned with a perspective that they are tenaciously holding on to. I would suggest that there's more in agreement in many ways than that we have it different. I mean, I sometimes try to describe this as, let's talk about what's more at the center for all of us than what's at the edges in this discussion. And if we can have that kind of conversation and engagement, first of all, legislators would find more sense and common sense and support from people who have been harmed than they realize. Many times when they engage folks, they're catching a person at that worst possible moment when the emotional reactions are quite profound and intense. But that typically doesn't define that person fully. It defines that moment of trauma. And those things can come out in justice proceedings because that's the focal point of the pressure. I'm looking for quote-unquote justice in the justice system, and it's understandable that the expressions and reactions to that process are going to come out around court proceedings, for instance, or around a declaration at the end of the trial with sentencing and this kind of thing. But, you know, what I say is the people that I've met who've experienced harm, most of them are quite sensible people. If they were sensible before that experience, they're still sensible. They're just far more informed. And that's why it really can help for people within the system to understand how victimization, in other words, how trauma that is the result of loss, is actually working itself out in the life of a person. Because if we can understand that better, we can be more supportive of the individual, we can engage them in more effective ways, and we can involve them in a process that at the core it centers on them, or it should center on them. You know, the system is really the state versus the perpetrator, typically.
Yeah.
But we've become more sensitive to the fact that, wait a minute, that might be legally this case, but we're learning that the victim voice should be included in that.
But there are multiple stages of grief that an individual victim of a crime goes through, in the same way that any individual, any human being, goes through multiple stages of I'm not quite sure the word grief applies in every set of circumstances, but they have to process it. And and in many ways, it can become a profoundly meaningful experience and a profoundly negative experience in their lives, especially if they feel that nobody is listening to them. The story that I've brought up multiple times in the past is a television producer moving into the city of Baltimore, wants to be part of the Baltimore experience, and bikes were stolen from that person's garage, and it happened a third time, and boom, they moved. Now, here was Baltimore City's loss. Here was a loss to a metropolitan area, a loss to that person in terms of engaging all the wonderful things that can happen as you live in the city of Baltimore. But everybody was lost to that because of a property crime. Mm-hmm. Now, nobody is suggesting a person go to prison for a property crime, but at the same time, that experience that those individuals went through, they told me it was a grief-related process. There was fear. Mm-hmm. It was grief. They didn't like the way the criminal justice system responded to them. They didn't like the way that the police officer responded to them. And they withdrew.
That's right.
And, yeah, so that was a property crime.
Right. Oh, you know, what a great example. And, you know, you've got a lot of experience from your law enforcement days in interacting with people who've suffered loss. We commonly talk about the loss of innocence. That is a very common theme among people who are victimized and experience harm at the hands of others, whether that be a property crime or something around physical violence and the like. Because we want to believe that the system is working, or we want to believe that we're working in a society that cares or that law enforcement is supportive. And then we discover it isn't quite the way we thought. You weren't far off, though, in terms of grief, because there's kind of a theme in our victims' world that, you know, perpetration is about control, power and control. And what we've come to recognize is that we can't always say that about every perpetrator. You know, the guy who steals your car, I mean, who knows what his motives are? I really don't know. There are some crimes where we say, yeah, it's about power and control. We typically see that in domestic violence, for instance. Mm-hmm. But the one thing we can say, I think, very consistently, very confidently, and that is every victimization, victims experience the loss of power and the loss of control. And I suspect if we were to interview the individual, you know, the producer, he is describing that sensation of, you know, I feel like I'm out of control here. I don't have control in this situation. I'm going to take control. Translated, I'm moving. I'm moving to an area where I feel like I'm more in control, or there are more resources available to me, more a greater commitment to safety.
And it just strikes me that, again, we talk about this in terms of a particular family, but it is a community's loss. It is a city's loss. It is a loss of taxpayer dollars.
That's right.
It is the loss of the joy of living in a major metropolitan area and all the good things that go along with that. So there are multiple losses to multiple people at multiple levels, but it's still, quote-unquote, just a property crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, it's great that you're really helping unpack some of the struggles that people have and then the tension that's created when maybe law enforcement or others respond and say, well, it was just a property crime. You know, you'll get we'll paint over the graffiti or whatever. But another thing you're pointing out as you use the word grief, I think grief is fair because a common reaction to loss is grief. Now, people don't necessarily think about it that way, apart from maybe a homicide or some other things, a very, you know, intimate relationship that is broken, like a divorce. We grieve the loss of that relationship. But in reality, that is many times what people are going through, and they don't even realize it. And of course, society or others are telling them, well, you know, why are you grieving over the fact that you had vandalism or stolen bikes or whatever? Well, there's a lot that could be behind that, just like you're describing, specifically the loss of that innocence that, you know, life, people, my society was one way, and I've learned now that it's different.
So the bottom line in all of this, Will, is that do we really understand what happens to victims of crime? Does the member of that legislative body, when he or she is trying to decide who goes to prison, who goes to jail, what compromises are we going to make? Because we do clearly understand that not everybody can go to jail. Not everybody can go to prison. There are limits and there are better ways on the part of some to operate the criminal justice system in a way that is fair, in a way that protects public safety, in a way that reduces the burden on taxpayers. So all of those things are in play. But when we are saying all of this and when we're interacting with victims of crime as judges, as police officers, as parole and probation agents, the bottom line question to me is, do we really understand what happens to victims of crime? Do we really understand those dynamics?
That's right. And that's a really great insight, because we should not fear trying to understand what they've experienced. That doesn't mean that we have to throw out the justice system or throw out rule of law or throw out due process. Quite frankly, we've experienced the opposite. And this kind of comes back to the victims' rights issue, but you know, you and I have talked about the constitutional amendment issue, that we have been working to promote in the United States constitutional amendment for a number of years. Why? Because victims under the law should have standing. The accused has standing under the United States Constitution, and all of that is important, you know, particularly under the Bill of Rights. But the victims of the same crime for which that individual's accused should have standing under the law to be able to have a place to speak, to engage, to act. And those rights should be protected. Of course, they need to be inculcated first. You know, because you're engaged on this issue, that 33 of the 50 states have victims' rights in their state constitutions. So it's a recognized value among the states. But still, the consistency for that, and then, of course, 17 states not having victims' rights makes it very difficult, not only in those states, but if you're in one state and you go across the border to a non-victims' rights state, you know, that complicates your life as well. So we've just been affirming that understanding victims, their needs, their rights, gives us a greater awareness of how we can respond in a fair and just and compassionate way to the needs of people who've been harmed by others.
We're more than halfway through the program. We're talking today to Will Marling. He's been by these microphones many times in the past. He is the executive director of the National Organization for Victim Assistance, www.trinova.org, www.trinova.org. Going back to the constitutional amendment, Will, again, the question is for the victims movement and for victims of crime. You know, the question was, do we understand, we in a criminal justice system, society, do we really understand what happens to victims of crime? And so what victims are essentially saying is that if I don't have constitutional protections, they're coming to the conclusion that they, the states that do not have constitutional amendments, or they, members of Congress, don't understand what it is that we're going through, because we need a national constitutional an amendment to the United States Constitution to protect victims of crime at the federal level, and we need it at the same time at the state level. And I guess sometimes they're simply saying we don't have it because they don't understand our experience.
Yeah.
And it's part of that continuing discussion of, do we really understand what happens to victims of crime?
That's right. I mean, you know, the Constitution and a rule of law society, the issue becomes, is it written down? Is it inculcated somewhere? We can say this is the right thing to do, but until we say this is the right thing to do and put it in writing, so to speak, then it can't be argued legally. It can be argued morally, ethically, and so on, but you know, the courts don't argue from that standpoint specifically. They open the law books. They open up the precedential imperatives and say, okay, where does this particular thing stand? And that's why we contend that raising the profile of crime victims in this country through a constitutional amendment is a profound opportunity to emphasize justice and really to deal with even some of these other issues. You know, the focus on over-incarceration, over-criminalization actually could be helped, in my view, by a discussion about victimization, because then the victims could talk about really where those issues lie with them,
mm-hmm.
rather than just passing laws that everybody says, well, that's a violation. You get arrested, you get charged, you get sent to jail. That's really not effective. And historically, you know, we've seen where those kinds of approaches and attitudes really aren't necessarily productive. You know, there's been this migration from, you know, tough on crime to right on crime to, you know, straight on crime and this kind of stuff. And all of those are meaningful attempts in some ways, I think, to focus on justice. I want to presume, you know, that people have good intentions. But at the heart of it, the question is, who really suffers the most when it comes to crime, and how do we address it? How do we promote safety and security in a fiscally responsible way in our society and really look at the core issues, not caricatures, not emotional reactions, but really at the heart of it, what rights people should have who've suffered at the hands of another person.
The issue is compassion, and I think that that's how victims see it. Mm-hmm. But it goes all the way from the individual police officer who first contacts them, all the way up to Congress, all the way mm-hmm. up to the highest levels of the federal government. I think that's the way they see it. When I was a young police officer and I was out there, I would have times where I would be running from call to call to call. Mm-hmm. That doesn't give you an awful lot of time to meet human needs.
Yep.
If it's a property crime or if it's a violent crime, I need to get as much information as I possibly can to try to solve that crime, to pass it on to detectives and to process a crime scene. I really don't have a lot of time to hold your hand, ma'am. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a realistic point of view, an unfortunate point of view, all at the same time. The police officer, he or she can only do so much, yet that person has just gone through something that will remain with them for the rest of their lives. So it is compassion. Do we build in compassion? Do we build in understanding all the way from the police officer to the prosecutor, to the courts, mm-hmm. to the public defender, to the entire criminal justice system? So understanding the victim experience becomes, do we have sufficient compassion for that victim's experience? And at the same time, do we have built-in processes to be compassionate to that individual? Now, that's a very complicated question. I hope it made sense.
It did, yeah. And what I would want to say is, actually, there's tremendous hope for engaging other people in ways that demonstrate compassion. Because you can be empathetic, and that's an ability to understand and feel what people are experiencing in some ways. And, you know, compassion work, as it's commonly called, many times are people who actually get that intuitively, instinctively. You know, they look at a person, they hear their story, and they recognize, okay, I understand maybe what may be going on in a deep way. Compassion itself is an opportunity to demonstrate to another person that I'm hearing you and I'm supporting you. And those things can be done on the front end very simply. How many times have I taken a victim assistance call here at our office? You know, we have a toll-free victim assistance number, 800-TRI-NOVA. Mm-hmm. I've probably taken 3,500 to 4,000 victim assistance calls myself in my tenure as executive director.
Sure.
And the person says, you know, I called police. They wouldn't take a report. That's all they wanted. They didn't want a hug from the officer. They didn't want, you know, whole hand-holding. Most people understand that officers have a difficult job to do. What do they want out of that officer? They want them to listen to them and respond in a meaningful and professional way. Mm-hmm. And as I like to say, you know, law enforcement demonstrates their commitment to a serious response when they do one of three things, typically. They take out their pen to take a report, they mm-hmm. take out their handcuffs to make an arrest, or they take out their firearm to put down a very bad situation. Mm-hmm. So at the very least, when an officer pulls out his or her pen to take a police report, they might not realize that that act right there is the beginning of demonstrating that I'm listening and I'm caring because I'm taking official action. You know, I've been on the street with officers, you know, worked with law enforcement, and it's a real temptation to talk people out of doing, you know, paper, because you're like, well, it's work. Yeah, it's work. But you don't know why they want that, and you don't know why they need that. And the fact is that that issue right there might be so powerful to being heard that it helps move them forward. And so, go ahead.
But it's also the fact that we have built in certain mechanisms into the criminal justice system, getting us back to the constitutional amendment. But I want to be a lot more basic than that. We have victims advocates now. We have mm-hmm. victims advocates here at the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency. We have victims advocates within the court systems. We have victims advocates in law enforcement. We have independent victims advocates. We have victims advocates for domestic violence. We have domestic victims advocates for rape and other sexual assaults. We have victims' advocates for child-related crimes. So we now have people who are either paid or volunteer to provide that hand-holding all the way through the criminal justice system. Yes, we do want that police officer to take the report. We do want that police officer to show some degree of compassion. But we now have specialists who are in place to help that person through the system and solve their immediate needs.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the victim advocates are really part of our family, and we consider like ourselves a very tiny tip of an incredibly rich and deep iceberg of victim advocacy. The challenge we face, though, Len, is that, first of all, we're a land of jurisdictions, and even how the advocates are placed, where they serve, can be quite varied from place to place. Some advocates are placed in police departments, and actually they might be nearly a first responder. Others are placed out of a prosecutor's office, so their engagement with a victim might be well down the path. That's why we emphasize the fact that law enforcement's commitment to training and understanding how to engage somebody who's been harmed is really paramount, because they're commonly the very first engagement with the justice system one way or another. And so, yeah, I mean, the people that I know who are advocates are pound for pound the most incredible, dedicated people there are, and they do amazing work. But within the justice system, you know, there are many opportunities to help victims be heard and move forward. I like to say that the best demonstration of this kind of thing is a three-legged stool, where you have compassion, you have competence, and you have commitment.
Mm-hmm.
The compassion really is the first thing that people see. But if you only have compassion, you don't really have an opportunity to follow through with the skills necessary as an officer, for instance, to do an investigation or do the paperwork, or an advocate to engage, because there's a lot of skills associated with this. That compassion resource kind of wears thin to people. They're like, well, yeah, he's a nice guy, she's a nice woman, but you know, they didn't help me in this investigation. And then, of course, you need the commitment to bring it all together. And, you know, I've seen some incredible officers, law enforcement individuals who really demonstrate those three things. And it's very common to see advocates that way. But that's really what we're trying to promote here, is compassion is the very first thing people see. If you don't give that communication to them that you're wanting to hear, you're wanting to understand, even when, like you're saying, you're going from call to call, you know, it's hard for them to get to the next step and say, well, I'm going to trust this individual to take my report even sometimes.
And it's hard in terms of the fact that we depend upon victims of crime to cooperate with us within the criminal justice system in terms of the prosecutorial process and in terms of the remediation process. If they blow that relationship from the very beginning, it makes all the rest of it that much more difficult to accomplish.
Yeah, no question. I mean, like anything,
Final minutes of the program, I do want to get on the training, because what we're doing, what the National Organization for Victim Assistance has been doing for decades, and what you're currently doing for the Department of Defense, is training individuals to deal with these issues at all levels, not just at the individual level, dealing with that individual person who has suffered through that criminal victimization, but all the way up to the advocacy level. It's a matter of structure to deal with these issues and training, and that's the heart and soul of what you guys have been doing over the course of the last couple of decades, correct?
Yeah, we're at our core, we're all about training, because, again, you've got compassion, but to have competence, you have to have competencies, and those revolve around skills and training and refined experience and continuing education that enhance our ability to serve those people. Now, just to clarify, you've been a very supportive person for us at NOVA. Our engagement with the Department of Defense specifically is a certification program, because the Department of Defense has its own prescribed training, as you can imagine, mm-hmm. each of the services. But we recognize that the value that the military is trying to bring to training in this area of advocacy is growing, and we appreciate that. I obviously can't speak for them, but I can affirm that I appreciate the efforts that are being made there. And so what we're trying to continue to do is to speak into all kinds of training contexts. We have a NOVA Victim Assistance Academy that we have developed because there are academies in many states, and there's also a National Victim Assistance Academy through the Office of Victims of Crime. But we're really trying to fill voids that don't exist in areas of training as well.
All right, we're going to have to wrap up. Well, as always, it's been an enlightening experience. Every time I talk to you, I learn something something new in terms of victims' rights and what we within the criminal justice system need to understand about victims' rights. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today has been Will Marling. He is the executive director of the National Organization for Victim Assistance, www.try.trinova.org, www.trinova.org. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We appreciate your comments. We even appreciate your criticisms, and we want everybody to have themselves a very pleasant day.